So you did just part time?
Did mine part time, and I had two kids, so I had two maternity leaves in it.
Wow.
So it took me 6.5 years to do my GP training.
Oh my God.
But GP, you know, GP is like the shortest training program you can do.
Really?
Yeah.
So what's...
So most like consultant posts, hospital consultant posts are 7 years.
Okay. Hi guys, welcome to another episode of What Your Best Friend Does, where we talk about what your best friends do so you don't have to. Today I'm joined by my best friend, the doctor, Jess.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Lovely to have you. I mean, it's great to finally get like a serious, you know, you save lives. Or maybe you do, maybe you don't. We're about to get into it.
Yeah, you'll find out.
But before we start, we like to do a little icebreaker. Mm-hmm. What did you want to be growing up?
I wanted to be a journalist.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
Any reason why?
I just liked writing. I liked being creative. I wanted to like work in some kind of magazine as a glossy magazine, as a journalist or editor. That was the dream.
So you wanted to be a journalist, but yeah, you ended up becoming a doctor.
That's right.
My first question is, how many years of study does that take?
A bloody long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So first of all, you do your degree. So I did my Bachelor of Medicine, Bachelor of Surgery.
Okay.
So that took 6 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah. The standard is 5 years.
Yeah.
Took me 6 because I did an extra year at the beginning.
Okay.
Because I hadn't done any science A-levels.
So if you don't do science A-levels, you're going to have to do an extra year at uni. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the normal one's 5 years. I think they might be talking about starting to shorten it a little bit because obviously we're losing doctors.
Yeah.
6 years at uni, and then you do 2 years foundation, like mandatory foundation training in the hospital.
Okay. So like work, on-site work experience.
Yeah, so you're working as a doctor, you are a fully qualified doctor, but mm-hmm. you just have to get through these first 2 years basically, and you rotate around different specialties and just get experience in lots of different areas.
Okay.
And then you can choose what to specialize in after that. So that took 8 years, and then I did...
What? So after 6 years study?
No, so you do your 6 years and your 2 years, so together it's 8.
Okay.
And then you get to choose what you actually want to do in the field of medicine.
Yeah.
So I chose general practice.
Okay.
And general practice is 3 years full-time training.
Wow.
So we're at
11 years. So you did just part-time?
Mine part-time, and I had two kids, so I had two maternity leaves in it.
Wow.
So it took me 6.5 years to do my GP training. It takes ages, basically, the answer to your question.
Oh my God.
But GP, you know, GP is like the shortest training program you can do.
Really?
Yeah.
So what's...
So most like consultant posts, hospital consultant posts are 7 years.
Okay.
So you do... your 5 or 6 years at uni, then your 2 years foundation training, and then 7 years extra training to be a consultant.
And then this might sound like a silly question, but you mentioned you specialized in general practice.
Yeah.
How many different disciplines are there that you can specialize in? Is it hundreds? Is it thousands? Is it just a few?
Not thousands, but I don't know how many there are.
Okay. So
but there's all sorts.
There's quite a lot.
Yeah. Like pediatrics, obs and gyne, you know, general medicine, stroke medicine. There's loads and loads of options.
Okay. Yeah. So... do your research.
Yeah.
Okay. And then that brings us to today. So typically what I like to do on this show is talk about your journey to this point. Mm-hmm. You've kind of spoken about a lot there, but is there anything else that we've missed? Anything else you want to add?
So I personally have a portfolio career.
Okay.
So it's becoming more people are starting to do that more in general practice because it is slightly more flexible as a specialty anyway.
What's a portfolio career?
So it's when you do loads of different stuff.
Okay.
Not
basically
just, you don't just do your like specialty, you do other things too.
Okay.
So obviously I do my GP work, mm-hmm. and I also specialised in aesthetic medicine.
Oh wow.
So I have my own aesthetic clinic, and that actually takes up the majority of my time now.
Okay.
And then I also do lecturing at an aesthetics academy in London that teaches new medics who are getting into the field of aesthetics.
Okay. And with each of those, are they all paid, right? like, yes, you're not lecturing for free and like giving back as
I'm
an example.
Not. Sorry, okay. guys.
Oh, all right. So if we bring it back to your work as a GP,
yeah.
Talk me through what a typical day looks like as a GP.
Well, it depends whether you're on call or not. First of all, GPs always dread being on call because it's an extra busy day. But if you're just having a standard day, obviously varies between practices, but generally you get there by 8 a.m. if not before. And you might have a little meet up with the other GPs that are in that day and the practice manager, talk about any staffing issues, because there is usually some.
A lot of
short staffing at the moment. And then you start seeing patients at 8:30. You'll have a morning surgery. It'll be a mixture of face-to-face and telephone appointments. And then usually finish about 12:30. And then you do your paperwork. So boring stuff like all the referral letters, checking all your blood tests, checking letters from the hospital, which will request different things that you need to do. And then you go out and do your home visits.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Second half of the day?
Yeah.
Is that why the GP shuts early?
Well,
good to know.
It doesn't shut early, Vio. Okay. We're still working.
Okay, sorry.
That's the common misconception. I know. I literally remember when I told my brother I was going to do GP training, and he was like, oh, yeah, that's such a good idea. Easy money. All you do is sit in a swivel chair and you earn 100 grand a year. Well, I don't, unfortunately. And they don't even give you a swivel chair for free these days.
Well.
but yeah, so it's a busy day. After your home visits, then you do evening surgery. So it's usually from 3:30 till 6:30.
Okay.
So you finish seeing patients at 6:30. But obviously, we don't walk out the door at 6:30.
Of course.
So you then got to do all your admin from that evening surgery, all your letters again, all your blood test filing, and then you go home and cry.
Oh my God. So a lot to digest there.
Yeah.
Crazy day. It sounds like...
normal day, not when you're on call. On call is worse.
So that was going to be... So what is the difference between a normal day and being on call?
Again, it varies depending on what your practice, what their setup is. But generally, you... are just like a dog's body. You just have to deal with all the firefighting. Okay. And we all know that there's too many patients for each practice, essentially. We all know how hard it is to get in to see your GP. And the reason it's so difficult is just because the demand exceeds capacity so much. So the job of the on-call doctor is quite stressful because you're kind of managing all the patients that try and contact the practice that day. You're trying to deal with as many as possible and firefight, basically. So you're triaging. So you're trying to prioritise who needs to be seen face-to-face, who can get away with just a phone call, who can be pushed back a week. So, yeah, it's tricky because obviously everyone wants contact that day and it's just impossible to do that.
So to typically, let's say in a regular week or month, how many times would you be on call?
Generally, most people will do 1 in 4 days on call. So kind of once a week you're on call.
Damn, that's a lot.
Yeah.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
All right. I've got so many questions. do you enjoy it?
Yeah, I do. I do enjoy it. I fell out of love with it a little bit when I was doing it full time. But now I don't do GP full time anymore. I do enjoy my GP days. That's variety. It's challenging. It's very fast paced. No day's the same. No two patients are the same. So yeah, I do enjoy it. It's incredibly stressful, but it's rewarding at times.
With COVID
and
like the advancements of like AI and stuff like that, have you seen, I suppose, less pressure? Is there more of a move to people taking appointments online, or no, you're as busy as ever?
I think obviously you're a little techno whiz. the NHS is always going to be furthest behind on advancements in technology, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So for example, we still have to log into like 3 different platforms each morning. Like,
really?
IT in the NHS is a total shit show. So I can't see things changing quickly.
Oh, no.
In terms of online appointments, not something we offer at all at our practice.
And you've mentioned that it takes a long time for kind of the NHS to catch up.
Yeah.
In terms of the timeline of you being in the NHS, what changes have you seen?
In terms of technology or just in general?
Just in general.
Well, it's probably going to sound really negative and depressing, but essentially I see the two main changes I've seen, so I've been in it about 10 years now, is one, morale has gone down.
Oh my goodness. Okay, that's deep.
So really, really low morale, widespread low morale and dissatisfaction and burnout. And less staff. I guess the two are linked together.
Oh my God. And, yeah, you know, putting you on the spot here, what do you think can be done from your standpoint to improve morale, hopefully retain better staff?
I think improving pay, mm-hmm, and improving working conditions. Mm-hmm. So that, to be honest, the working conditions feel so challenging because you're always so short-staffed and so stretched. Mm. So you'll never really feeling like you're able to give your best because you're stretched too thin. Mm-hmm. So I think if those two things improved, they'd have a much better retention rate.
So with that in mind, like, what are your views on like the strikes that have been going on? Very topical, actually. Have you been striking?
I haven't, because I'm not a junior doctor.
Okay.
So as a general practitioner, there haven't been any specific strikes, mm-hmm, but I do support the junior doctor striking 100%.
Any message for the listeners, to the people who, you know, might need to take note?
Yeah, give them more money.
No, I love that. Yeah, this is a good one. So after all the years of studying, right, so I think, you know, it calculated up to about 11, 12 years for you. What's the entry level salary for like a GP or the role you took up? Because I think there's this, you know, there's this thing, a lot of African parents want their kids to be doctors. It pays really well. Yeah. But obviously with the strikes and stuff going on, maybe this isn't the case. So you do all this study, mm-hmm, you get your first job. Do you mind sharing how much you earn?
So when I started off, after my 6 years at medical school, and obviously clocking up all the debt that comes with that, because it's, you know, colossal. My student loan is colossal, guys. Yeah. So I started on 22 grand.
What?
Oh, are you baffled?
So this is...
You need to spread the word, see? Because everyone thinks that, like, doctors have it easy, doctors are rich, but the amount of work you have to put in and the amount you get back is low compared to other starting salaries of professional jobs with that much, where you have that much training.
Pressure as well. And just to be clear on that, is it 22 grand because maybe, like, did you start in London? Were you outside of London?
I was outside of London. I did it in Nottingham. I'm talking about my starting salary fresh out of med school as a foundation doctor.
Okay.
So I was working as a doctor, mm-hmm, obviously in charge of patients. That was 10 years ago now. Things have changed a bit. There was a doctor strike back in, I think it was 2015, where we negotiated a bit of a rise for the starting salary because, mm-hmm, it was considered quite low even back then. Mm-hmm. So the starting salary today for a foundation doctor is 29,000.
That's still...
Still, if you look at
grad
schemes...
It's still under the average.
It's low, isn't it?
Yeah.
But your standard grad scheme, when you do 3 years at uni, you usually get higher than that, but that's the starting salary for a doctor.
29 grand?
Yeah.
Pay these people more money.
You need to get out on the next time they're striking, get on the picket and make yourself a little sign.
I've got some back issues. I don't know. Man. No, I'm joking. So you've mentioned the fact that you're a portfolio doctor.
Yes.
And now you spend more time in aesthetics, right?
Yeah.
What are the push and pull factors for this decision?
Primarily for me, it was improving my work-life balance. Mm-hmm. So at the time when I started aesthetics, I was doing GP training, but during GP training, your specialist training, you still rotate around the hospital doing jobs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, hospital medicine is just incredibly taxing, mm-hmm, and the shift work, the shift pattern is not particularly conducive to family life. Mm. So that was a real challenge for me. And kind of after I had my first child, I was like, obviously back at work and thinking, oh God, this isn't what I wanted.
It's not the one
forever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Something needs to change. And yeah, started getting into aesthetics really from that, and then realized that I loved it. So now the other pull factor is enjoyment. Mm. And further down the line, the pull factor now is also financial, mm-hmm, but that took a long time to build to that state where it's financially also rewarding.
Okay, so you were pushed out of doing your main doctor work just, mm-hmm, because it wasn't sustainable, the amount you were working for the amount you're getting paid.
Yeah.
And now you're doing something that you enjoy more, mm-hmm, and is rewarding you more. I'm finding it hard to make a case here for being a doctor, but hey, listen on.
I still do GP, but I just do it one day a week.
doing it one day a week, mm-hmm. do you see the same people then? Or how does it work? They're missing out 4 days worth of patients.
But you never see the same people anymore. Okay. And that's something that's really changed in general practice over the last 20 years or so.
Okay.
Because the demand is so high, I don't know what your experience is as a patient, but you tend to never really see the same doctor again anyway. Mm-hmm. You just see whoever has the availability on the day. It's mm-hmm. you've kind of lost that continuity that you used to have with a family doctor where you'd always see them. They knew you, they knew your family, they knew your mum, they knew everything about your history. We don't have that now. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really make a difference to the patient quality because mm-hmm. you're just seeing that patient on the day. So they're still getting the same service.
And then apologies if I'm putting you on the spot here. What's the difference between what you, because I'm assuming you're a GP for the NHS
yes.
and then private doctor.
Yes.
What is the difference?
So GP I work for a practice as a salaried GP. Mm-hmm. So they pay me a salary for the work that I do there. So I guess the difference with my private work is that my private work is essentially self-employed work. So I have a limited company. And it
no, but I mean like, also, sorry to jump in. For somebody who was a private doctor, because you know sometimes through work you can get private healthcare.
Yeah.
You're not, or are you seeing patients privately as
no,
well?
No, so yeah. I don't do private GP work.
Okay.
Yet.
But that's something that's on the horizon.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Oh, nice. All right. So what would you say, I know you don't do as much GP stuff now, but you're still doing it one day a week. What would the most rewarding thing be about that job?
I guess when you feel like you've made a real difference, it's hard sometimes to feel that reward mm-hmm. because time is so constricted. You have 10 minutes. And really, you should only spend 7 minutes of that with the patient in front of you because you've got to write your notes within that time as well.
Wow.
It's incredibly fast paced. So I understand why people, you know, you get it all the time. Oh, I felt fobbed off. I felt this. I mean, yeah, some GPs are just a bit shit.
Yeah.
denying that. But the majority of them are trying their hardest. And if you only have 7 minutes to deal with someone, you've got to get through the questions you need to ask to rule out the red flags, to rule out anything really sinister. And then you go from there. So it's hard to find it rewarding because people maybe don't feel like you take enough time, uh-huh. but you don't have the time. Uh-huh. But sometimes you really break through, and obviously we run late a lot because we have to take longer with certain patients. Personally, I find my consultation appointments about mental health the most rewarding. Mm-hmm. It's just something that I seem to kind of excel at. So I tend to get more mental health patients from at my practice than most.
Oh, okay. Jess Mondays.
Yeah.
Jess Mondays for all your... Actually, let me not make a joke. Let me not get cancelled. Sorry, yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah, so I'd say most rewarding is I guess just any time the patient feels like you've really listened to them and you've really made a difference.
Okay, great. And in terms of like most stressful, I mean, I know the hours are crazy, but what else would you say?
In GP, most stressful is the pressure, the pace of work.
Is there... And I'm putting you on the spot here. Do GPs misdiagnose a lot? And is that down to the pressure and like the fact that you've got to see people within 7 minutes?
I don't know if they misdiagnose a lot. I wouldn't say that. But obviously we're human and all GPs will make some mistakes within their career where they will miss something. Mm-hmm. Or people will look back at their work and think that they should have diagnosed something else. Mm-hmm. But yeah, at the end of the day, you know, when you have humans treating you, there's going to be some slight degree of error. Mm-hmm. And being stretched too thin certainly increases the risk of errors happening.
So do you know, coming back to what I was saying earlier, do you think that a move towards more technological assistance could be beneficial both for you as a worker and for the person receiving help in future? Not that I'm trying to replace your job.
I honestly don't know. Okay. I'm like a technical dinosaur.
Okay.
I'm not the girl to ask about techno advances.
Watch this space.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm coming back. All right.
Come help us.
So we'll move into aesthetics now. Mm-hmm. We've spoken about what a typical day as a GP looks like. What does a typical day in your practice look like?
Well, I swan out of bed about 10 o'clock. No, I'm joking. No, it is nice because you set your hours. So there's that flexibility. Mm-hmm. So for my GP days, obviously I'm getting up crack of dawn, getting out of the house, going straight to work, being there at 7:30. Mm-hmm. Whereas my aesthetic days, I get up with the kids, give them breakfast, I take them to school, mm-hmm. which is amazing. I never got to do that. You can't take your kids and pick your kids up from school in GP. It's mm-hmm. impossible. And then, yeah, I usually start about 10 o'clock. Wow. And I'll see patients either till 3 and then pick the kids up and then go back to work when my husband is home.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I have them in like after school club or whatever, then I'll just work straight through to mm-hmm. the evening.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's just very, very, very different. The pace is slower.
Any notes needed to be written up on your clients?
Notes?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, but not like in GP.
Okay.
Yeah, because in GP you have to record like loads and loads of stuff, mm-hmm. all for litigation reasons. But in aesthetics, it's not like that.
And like, how did you get into aesthetics? Obviously, we've spoken about all of the studying you did.
Yeah.
Is it something that as you were reading up on, I don't know, other things, it just came to be? Or mm-hmm. how did your interest come about?
I'd say aesthetic medicine as a field is growing really quickly, and now more people are aware of it
mm-hmm.
In terms of kind of young doctors or even people at medical school going, you know, through their journey at university.
Mm-hmm.
It was never mentioned when I was at uni or anything, so I wasn't even really aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
I started getting interested in it when I started having stuff done myself.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Botox.
Okay.
Yeah, that kind of started my interest in it, because I've always enjoyed, you know, like beauty side of things and like wanting to look or feel my best.
Mm-hmm.
And then started having some treatments done myself. I actually was struggling to find anywhere in Nottingham where I'm based that I really felt was a really high standard mm-hmm. and was also doctor led.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a few places back then, but I was surprised at how the majority of people offering things like, you know, Botox injections or dermal fillers were kind of essentially unqualified. It's a mm-hmm. very unregulated industry.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of piqued my interest as well. I thought, oh, you know, I think I'd really enjoy this, bit of a gap in the market. And also I'm just mad and never seem to want to stop learning.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I just thought, oh, I know what I'll do. I was on maternity leave and I thought I'll just do another diploma because I obviously don't have enough time as it is.
So what did you get your diploma in?
So my first maternity leave, I got it in women's health.
Wow.
With the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Mm-hmm. And then my second maternity leave, I did my diploma in aesthetic medicine. To be fair, that took me years. I started it in maternity leave.
You're a student of life. That's what you are. So obviously I've been on your Instagram. I'm going to give it its first plug, Your Beauty Doctor. Go check it out, guys, for anybody who wants to learn about beauty and beauty, aesthetics, looking good, the transformations that Jess does. Go and check it out.
When are you coming?
You just said I need it deeply. Oh wow, Shade of my own podcast. No. So yeah, I was on it, and you know, you talk about the fact that you're all about natural results.
Yeah.
Right. So what are the type of treatments that you're actually giving to your customers? You've mentioned Botox, but what else is there?
Yeah, so Botox, dermal fillers, Botox and fillers are the most popular.
Mm-hmm.
So fillers, everyone kind of, if you don't know much about it, you'll probably get a vision in your head of like
oversized lips.
Yeah, Katie Price or, you know, Towie style things, maybe people going a little bit too far.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, dermal fillers, when done correctly, can look really, really natural, mm-hmm. kind of undetectable, but mm-hmm. still make a good impact and refresh you overall.
Mm-hmm.
What else? We do fat dissolving. So Aqualix fat dissolving injections. It's when you inject a solution, it kills fat cells, gets rid of stubborn pockets of fat.
Really?
Yeah, so my most common area people have is their chin.
Okay.
Yeah. So okay. Kind of if they're conscious of that area.
Mm-hmm.
Chemical peels, skincare, medical grade skincare, rejuvenation, and injectable skin boosters like Profilo are also very popular.
There's a lot you can get done.
Stunned silence. I'm
like, goodness gracious. And as you were saying all that, you know, you mentioned the Katie Price example.
Yeah.
Is there ever like people come to you, they want stuff and you're just like, no, like, or you've got too much, or yeah, like stop. Does that happen and how do you address that?
It does happen actually quite a lot.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, I do say no a lot to patients.
Why would you typically say no?
So it'll either be a patient coming for the first time and, you know, maybe they've booked, for example, lip filler, and then you see them face to face. And during the consultation, I will explain to them that I'm not willing to do the treatment because, for example, they've got a lot of filler there already,
mm-hmm.
or they've got lip filler that has migrated. So, you know, when people kind of get that puffy top lip here and it looks a bit ducky or trout pouty, that's usually when they've had too much filler or it's migrated, so it doesn't look natural anymore.
What does migrated mean?
When it starts, so it moves from the pink of the lip where you want it to be into the filter and basically into the white area of the lip.
I just say,
so it gets puffy.
Migration sounds so peak. Yeah. It's like, your lip ain't doing what it's supposed to. Your lip gold. It's migrating.
So I say no to them. I don't say no. I say, look, I'm not willing to treat because of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
I specialise in natural results. And I kind of recommend what I think would be in their best interest, which would be to dissolve the migrated filler. And then if they want to have filler again with me, we can then do filler at a later date once all of the old filler is completely gone.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Yeah.
And you've mentioned like so many treatments that you do. Like, have you noticed like an emerging trend in like a specific type of treatment?
I think there is an increase in popularity in skin boosters, which are kind of, they're injectable, it's injectable hyaluronic acid essentially, and stimulates your own skin to produce more collagen and elastin.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than kind of being a filler that stays in your tissues, it's only there for roughly 28 days and it's gone. And at that time, it's kind of triggered your own skin to rejuvenate. So that's becoming more and more popular.
Okay. And what would you say is a common misconception in the aesthetics industry?
I would say, one, that you make people look weird. Like, I remember when I was like first getting into it and my dad was like, oh God, darling, don't make people look like that, do you?
Yeah.
You know, there's still that whole thing. But I always say to my patients, if you can tell just from looking at someone in the street, they've had Botox and fillers and they've had bad Botox and fillers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing, looking weird. Second thing, I guess, would be probably more aimed maybe at people who are just wanting to get into aesthetics, that it's easy money.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not. Mm-hmm. To be really, really good in the field, obviously you're paying for your entire education essentially. So, I mean, I must have invested so much money.
Ballpark figure?
I mean, my level 7 was 10 grand.
Wow.
That's my diploma.
And there's 1 to 6?
No.
Oh, okay, sorry.
No, level 7 diploma is like a kind of master's equivalent, so that was about 10 grand.
Wow.
But each course I go on, I'm going on a course on Sunday actually, and that's 800 quid. So if you really want to be treated by the best, then you make sure that they're constantly going on courses, because aesthetic medicine is a field that's advancing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, I don't know. I dread to think how much I've spent.
And
I don't want to think about it.
And just in follow-up to that, so you mentioned that it's advancing all the time.
Yeah.
Is it just the courses that you're using to stay on top of things, or is there anywhere else you get your information?
I guess courses are important, going to conferences. So mm-hmm. I go to quite a few conferences each year with kind of the leading aesthetic experts, seeing them talk, seeing them inject.
Mm-hmm.
And being part of the aesthetics community, networking. I also do teaching, so I am a clinical trainer and lecturer for Acquisition Aesthetics, mm-hmm. which is kind of one of the leading aesthetics academies. They've got various training centres throughout the UK, but their main one's in London.
Mm-hmm.
And they teach kind of new medical professionals who are just starting out in aesthetics or are wanting to improve their skills if they're already in it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I do that as well. And I think that really helps keep you on top of your game, mm-hmm. because obviously you're being questioned constantly.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps too. And being part of that network and that faculty, because
mm-hmm.
They're all kind of, you know, top of their game, I get to be with them and we're always learning from each other as well. So whenever mm-hmm. we do a teaching day, we'll mm-hmm. always learn something new off each other too. So that's great.
Oh my God, I've got so many questions going through my mind. I just need to make sure that I stay on track. any resources that anybody who's potentially looking to get into the aesthetic game, mm-hmm. like you've mentioned some conferences, you mentioned the courses.
Yeah.
Are there any like particular websites that people should go to get this information?
So I would go to Acquisition Aesthetics.
Acquisition Aesthetics, yep, .com. Good
plug there.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's .co.uk, whatever.
Okay.
So have a look on there and you'd start with their foundation course.
Okay.
Foundation, fillers and Botox. And from there, you'd be able to practice straight away.
Do you have to pay for those courses?
Yes, of course.
Use code BIO10 for 10% off. That's a joke.
I do actually have a code. I think I do actually have a code.
If you do, look, to anybody who listens to this and gets this far into the podcast, we will put the code.
Yeah, we can put the code. Or if you Instagram message me, I'll give you a code, because I do have a special trainer this code for 10% off, but God knows what it is right now.
Just break me some.
DM me. But make sure, my advice if you're getting into it would be, one, I wouldn't bother getting into it now unless you are a healthcare professional.
Okay.
So, you know, whether you're a doctor, dentist, nurse.
Why not?
Because the industry is currently unregulated, mm-hmm. but it is currently going through government to become a regulated industry again.
Okay.
So they're trying basically to make it towards medical professionals again.
Okay.
So because at the moment the majority of practitioners are beauticians, kind of beauty related, but at the end of the day we're using medical devices and we're using Botox as a prescription only drug.
Mm-hmm.
So really it should only be given prescribed by a prescriber. So if you are going to your local beauticians getting Botox and you haven't seen a prescriber, aka a doctor or a nurse prescriber before, to get your prescription, then they're doing it illegally and they're getting it imported. They're not getting it from a UK registered pharmacy, so be careful. That's why you see all these botched jobs.
Wow. Yeah. So moral of the story,
come to me.
Go to Dr. Jess. And you actually do clinics in London as well, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
although you're based in Nottingham, so yeah.
Yeah.
Come, I'll give you a code. Get some money off. I'm joking.
Yeah, we'll give you a special discount.
So just to touch on what you've just said there, yeah. with regards to beauticians. So beauticians are unregulated typically.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is illegal.
No, it's not illegal what they're doing.
Okay.
They are allowed to do fillers. That's absolutely fine. But in terms of Botox,
yeah.
Botox is a prescription only drug.
Okay.
So they can give the Botox, they can inject it into your face, absolutely fine.
Yeah.
But how do they get that prescription? How do they get the Botox? That's what you need to look at.
Okay.
So what typically happens, I mean, I personally choose not to prescribe for anyone that isn't not a healthcare professional, but mm-hmm. I have lots of nurses that are really great at in their aesthetic roles. They're aesthetic nurses, they have their own clinics, and I will go to their premises and I will do a prescription clinic. I will see their patients face to face. I will do a medical questionnaire. And if there's no contraindications, I will write them a prescription for Botox
okay.
specific for them.
Okay.
So that then their nurse can give it to them.
Okay.
So that's how the legit people do it.
Okay.
Yeah. And then you've got people who are in the beauty industry and maybe they can't get a prescriber, I don't know. And they just get it online. You mm-hmm. can get it from China, eBay. But you don't really know what's in it if it's not from a UK farm.
Mate, bun getting things put in my face that are coming from eBay. Are you mad? Are you mad?
Honestly, that's what they don't, people don't seem to mind.
Okay, so just so we're unequivocally clear.
Yeah.
For anybody who's looking to get like a medical treatment, shall
yes.
we say, what would be the optimal process from the doctor?
So I would, if you're going to get any aesthetic treatment involving injectables, I personally would choose to go to a healthcare professional.
Okay.
Just because of the background they've got in from their other experience in that role. So for example, I also know what to do with complications.
Mm.
I can also prescribe for complications.
Mm-hmm.
One of the main risks of dermal filler is something called a vascular occlusion. So that's when the filler can enter into a blood vessel, specifically an artery, supplying that area of the face.
Mm-hmm.
So if that was to get blocked and be left untreated, the area of the skin essentially dies. You can even get more serious consequences like blindness. It can be very significant. It's very rare,
mm-hmm.
but it can happen. And you have to be able to recognize it if it's happened and mm-hmm. treat it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that I think is most important, is to go to someone who can treat any complication.
Mm-hmm.
And again, hyaluronidase, which is the substance we use to dissolve filler,
mm-hmm.
Is also prescribed.
It sounds like there's a business in there somewhere. the beauty complicating diffuser. Come here when you've got a botch job, because it
yeah.
sounds like a lot of people are unregulated versus regulated.
I mean, I do right. deal with a lot of complications from other practitioners in the area. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're always willing to help. Ultimately, you know, whether you agree with what they've done or not, their patient is your primary concern. So I do always help when there is a complication.
That's the doctor in you, right?
Exactly.
There.
Exactly.
Yeah. So just as we did for the doctor aspect, what would you say the most stressful part of being an aesthetics or in the aesthetics world is?
So the majority of people doing aesthetics are self-employed. So like me, I don't work for anyone else. It's mm-hmm. just me. And so it can be stressful because, I mean, now I'm incredibly busy. It's great, but it's more stressful because you're managing your time, you're also running a business independently, and you never get to switch off. Because there can be complications in aesthetics, I would never just turn my phone off and think, oh, it's five, I've finished patient for the day, that's me done. Never. So if someone messaged me, as long as I was awake and saw it, at 11 o'clock at night, worried about an occlusion, for example, saying, oh, this doesn't feel right, I would see to them.
That's mad. And then what's the most rewarding?
Making people feel good. Honestly, it's so amazing. So people will come to you for all sorts of reasons. Loads of patients come to me when they've had personal tragic loss, when they've gone through massive life changes, like, you know, having kids, pregnancy, the weight fluctuations, menopause. And then they suddenly look in the mirror and they're just like, I don't know who I am. Like, I just don't look like me anymore. So making them feel like themselves again, getting their confidence back, making them be the best version of them.
Bloody.
It's so, honestly, I love it so much, so rewarding.
And just to kind of flip that, is there ever like, do you ever have patients where it's a bit like shallow hell, they're just never going to see themselves as beautiful and they just keep coming back for work?
Yeah, so that's another thing that you have to be really careful of in this industry. And again, something that I think maybe more healthcare professionals have more of an eye for, because there's a huge amount of people who have something called body dysmorphic disorder, and you're more likely to obviously see it in the aesthetics industry, where people are wanting to maybe change certain factors about themselves.
What would you define body dysmorphic order as?
It's when you kind of see something in the mirror, for example, in really kind of simplistic terms, that really bothers you and you think it's a massive problem that other people essentially can't see.
Okay.
So yeah, there are sometimes people where I think, I'm not going to treat you because you actually don't need anything. And I don't think that what you're asking me to do would make you feel better about what's bothering you. Yeah.
So when you come across these patients, obviously the first thing you do is decline to treat them.
Yeah.
But how do you assist in making sure that they get the necessary help to overcome this condition, or at least go on a pathway to overcome this condition?
So if I think, you know, it's really significant, then I will say to them, are you willing for me to write to your GP? Sometimes I've written a few letters to their own general practitioner, just kind of outlining my concerns, obviously with their consent, saying that I think they might have BDD. And essentially, the mainstay of treatment is therapy. So kind of signposting them to therapy services and where to go from there, and explaining a little bit about the condition, and trying to just give them that that insight into it.
That's so deep, man. It's so deep, but the world we live in, it's a deep world.
Yeah.
So we've spoken about you as a GP. We've spoken about you and your aesthetics practice.
Yeah.
You've also mentioned the fact that you lecture.
Yeah.
At an academy. So how often do you do that?
I probably do it once a month at the moment, like one weekend a month.
Is it online or in person?
In person. Okay. So I personally only work at the London Centre.
Okay.
And it's based in Oxford Circus. They've got their own property there, so it's kind of specific for aesthetic courses. And you have the morning doing lectures, giving kind of the background theory. And then in the afternoon, we just do practical sessions. So we'll have models come in. So everyone will inject on live models under my supervision, in small groups and with other clinical trainers present as well. So they're really, really good courses, really good quality. And actually that's who I did my initial training with, acquisition as well.
Okay.
So yeah, it's nice to kind of come full circle and be one of the expert trainers there now.
And with this like lecturing, and then what did you say? The lecturing and then in the afternoon it's the
like practical injecting. That's basically
it. Practical injecting. Is it like a one day you come in and you're done, or is it they come in monthly and that's part of like a course?
It depends. What there's different courses we run. So the foundation day, for example, when you're very first starting out, is one day and you can practice after that, but we always recommend doing obviously additional training because one day just isn't enough to gain the skills and confidence really that you need. So acquisition is particularly known for its level 7 diploma. Which is why I've got in aesthetic medicine. And then you come numerous times. You have the foundation course, the advanced course, then you have 5 separate days, mentoring days. And you also have master classes in things like lip filler, tear trough filler. So yeah, it's pretty thorough and intense, but it gets you to the top of your game.
Amazing. We will put a link to that, like we said, in the description if anybody wants to sign up.
Yeah.
Across both or across all three, or shall we just say in the doctor profession, what's an uncommon skill that you notice amongst your peers?
I probably more notice like what we all have in common, I guess.
And what would you say that is?
Being artistic.
Okay.
Because it's not just very prescriptive, especially when you're doing... It's, you know, expert dermal fillers, it's artistic. So as well as there being that obviously clinical skill side of things, I would say having a good eye for artistry.
Okay.
And really good people skills.
Okay.
Making them feel at ease. A lot of people come in very nervous.
You're about to inject and scared of needles, right?
Yeah. So, that's something that's, you know, in all of my reviews. Check out my 5-star Google reviews. Everyone always, it's always the first thing people will say on their review is, Dr. Jess put me at ease straight away. Dr. Jess is so professional, but so friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something that makes aesthetic practitioners, the ones that excel, they're really personable as well.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. And you know, it's funny, as you said, artistry, I really thought about attention to detail.
Yes.
Because if you're going to change somebody's face, you've got to like understand symmetry and this and that to make sure you have that finish. But I think it's very linked to artistry, as you said. What do you think has been the biggest factor in helping you to be successful?
I probably find it hard. In fact, everyone says I find it hard to switch off.
Mm-hmm.
That makes me very productive. I don't know. I just worked bloody hard.
Okay.
I always have. And I guess now I'm kind of getting to that stage where I can...
reap the fruits of your labour.
Yeah.
So work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
I think so.
You've mentioned being productive and never switching off.
Yeah.
Do you have any productivity hacks apart from working all the time?
Yeah. Just work 24/7 at the time. Love a to-do list. Yeah. Do you know what?
Yeah.
I feel... bad saying this to you because I know you love your technology, but I only switched from a paper diary this year.
Really?
Yeah. I used to have a paper diary and everything was in it, everything, my whole life.
Where did you store them?
Well,
it's a lot of clutter.
Yeah, the thing is, I used to carry it around with me as well, and then I got busier and busier and my diary had to get bigger, and then I couldn't fit it into my new YSL handbag, so I was like, I'm gonna have to go digital.
Wow.
That's what pushed me over the edge.
And
but I have a digital to-do list.
Okay.
As well now.
And it works?
It works. It helps me, because when you're on the run, when you're, you know, in the middle of 10 things, you're with the kids or doing the school run, and then you'll get an email or a message, because I don't have set time where you're at work and you're just sitting down doing admin. It's just constantly, you know, if it's something important, like, I don't know, remortgage the house. That's a recent one. No, just add it to the to-do list. Yeah. Or even simple things go on there.
Okay. I think that's a great hack. Yeah. Have a to-do list. I have one sometimes. So I think my tip to add to that is have a to-do list always.
Yeah.
Don't just pick and choose.
It's always on the top of my notes and I look at it like probably 10 times a day and I'll be like, oh yeah, I need to reply to that. Or
I feel like the next question I'm going to ask, I already know the answers, but I'm going to ask them anyway. We've spoken about 3 different things. For your role as a doctor, did you feel fairly compensated for what you did?
As a GP?
Yeah.
At this level now, when you actually are a GP, I think it's okay.
Okay.
I think as a junior doctor, it's bad.
Okay.
And I didn't feel compensated. But as a GP, it's okay.
And then as a lecturer and as owner of your aesthetics company, do you feel fairly compensated for what you do?
Yes, I do. But it's taken a long time to get there. Many, many years building up my client base to be so busy as I am now. So it takes a long time and a lot of investment. But now, yes, I do.
They call it like the 10-year overnight success because people will only look at you and your successes now, but they won't know about the 11 years of study you've done and everything else behind it.
Yeah.
So completely understand that. You've already answered this, but I'm asking it again. Do you feel like you've got a good work-life balance?
I feel like if Chris, my husband, was here, he'd be like, no. But I feel like I do.
Yeah.
My life is very hectic, but I guess that's because I choose to work around my kids so much.
Mm-hmm.
So like my day is quite bitty when I'm not in GP.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll like go to clinic while the kids are at school, come back, like pick them up from school, make them dinner.
Yeah.
And when Chris is home, I'll go back for the night.
Oh man.
So he probably feels like he never sees me.
But yeah.
I feel like I've got decent work-life balance. I like to do things with my friends, and people are always saying I'm always away because whenever I do have like a block of 3 or 4 days, I'll go away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll make the most of it.
So that leads me nicely into my next question. How do you unwind?
Wine.
Red, white, rosé, ooh.
I'm not fussy by it. Not fussy.
As long as I can drink it.
Exactly.
Wine.
I do. I like a drink. And okay. We went camping recently, which I was dragged into. Not my idea of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I made Chris turn the car around with the kids. And they were like, why are we going back, Mummy? And I was like, I've forgotten my wine glass. And I was like, I don't mind going camping as long as I can drink out of an actual glass. So yeah. No, I do like to have a drink. I like to see my friends, socialise, chill. I love going out for dinner. Yeah. Anything related to food and beverages and I'm there.
Yeah. What would your advice be to any medical professionals that might be suffering from burnout, as mm-hmm. you know, you might previously have done?
I think, see your GP. I think GPs are getting more aware of burnout in general. And mm-hmm. obviously they also have their own experiences as to what it can be like in the medical profession.
Mm-hmm.
Speak to friends, find colleagues that are supportive, because a lot of colleagues aren't, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a huge kind of blame game, and you often feel a lot of shame or guilt when you're burning out. Because you know, the NHS has quite a good team morale and you feel like you're letting the team down. So even though what you need is time off, mm-hmm. and essentially you need to be signed off work for a bit to recoup and recover.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't do that, then you just get more and more unwell. You'll get severe anxiety, severe depression. You'll be forced to be off for longer. But you feel too bad to take the time off. So it's like this constant negative cycle, because you don't want to make other people's jobs even worse, because they'll be even more short staffed.
Yeah, of course.
So yeah.
What are the symptoms of burnout? Because I've heard the term burnout, you know, used, but what actually is it?
There's different stages. Mm-hmm. So it tends to kind of just start with increasing stress levels, not sleeping, feeling anxious, starting to feel down, you know, dreading going to work, not mm-hmm. being able to switch off. That's mm-hmm. kind of generally how it starts.
Mm-hmm.
And then it can get kind of more and more severe and become kind of, you know, diagnosable depression, anxiety, all from work.
Wow.
And kind of later stages, more worrying stages actually of burnout, is kind of just when someone's just completely flat and just reaches complete indifference about mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a tricky one. We're learning more about it, I think. Yeah.
And, you know, in all honesty, if you're listening to this and you think it could be you, please go to a GP and seek help.
Yeah, yeah. And just find someone supportive in your workplace, because there are supportive people, and you usually know which ones are and which ones aren't. So kind of confide in them and talk to your friends, and just try not to feel guilty,
mm-hmm.
Because it is becoming more and more prevalent, to be honest, particularly after, you know, the many healthcare professionals that worked through the pandemic. It's just, obviously there's been a massive surge in burnout post having gone through all that. So.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Wow. And on that note of burnout, I feel
that
so bad. The way I'm like transitioning into my next question.
Oh God, what is it?
For any aspiring doctors or people that want to get into the medical profession,
mm-hmm.
or people who are looking to transition careers and say, oh, I want to leave my current profession behind and become a doctor, what would your advice be to them to get started?
First of all, I'd say think very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
God, does that sound really bad?
It's just honest.
Yeah, I would think really carefully about it, particularly if it's a career change, because mm-hmm. it's such a long journey. Think it through, really get, as long as you're happy with the reality of the day-to-day,
mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, if you want to do it, then apply to med school.
Mm-hmm. And then for those people who, you know, they might be about to go to university and they want to study medicine, what would you say to them?
It can be very challenging, and I found med school quite harrowing. I mean, don't get me wrong, I had a great time. Yeah. We've already talked about my love of alcohol. you have to work incredibly hard at med school. It's not to put down other degrees, because obviously they can be extremely challenging too, but it's just totally different. I was in lectures 9 to 5 every day. Most of my friends were doing other degrees that weren't quite so intense, I guess, in terms of how much you have to be there, and then you're on the ward. It's just, the exams are tough, but hard work and making sure you pace yourself.
Yeah.
And it's worth it in the end. Yeah. Because it's the first Wednesday of August is when all the F1s, so like the junior doctors, when you're coming fresh out of med school, start their first day as a doctor. Mm-hmm. It's the first Wednesday in August. So it's just been. Mm-hmm. They'll be like petrified. Be nice to them. I remember that feeling. But yeah, it gets easier and you build experience so quickly, and then your confidence will rise.
Jess, this has been an amazing conversation. We've got a quick fire round, but before we get into the quick fire round, where does Dr. Jess see herself in the next 5 and 10 years?
I'd just love to be living in the Bahamas. No, that's completely unrealistic. Hopefully just having eat better work-life balance, mm-hmm. again. Hopefully working a little bit less, to be honest.
Okay.
But having my clinics expand in Nottingham and London, I'd hope to be presenting at some conferences and things in the near future, mm-hmm. And continuing general practice. I think I will always continue doing that as well, even though it's a smaller part of my week now.
But go private.
But private.
yeah.
We'll see.
And just a final thought on that. Like, is there like any general advice you want to give to the listener? Anything that you kind of, live by that you want to share?
Talk to yourself how you talk to your best friend. That's quite a good podcast. Hey, plugged you in there.
There you go.
But as in, I used to talk, I still do it sometimes, but we tend to talk to ourselves in quite a negative way, mm-hmm. or about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I always say that to my patients in clinic as well. Mm-hmm. We're always our biggest critic. Mm. But try and talk to yourself how you talk to your best friend.
There you have it.
So you be kind to yourself and kind to
others. Talk to yourself like you talk to your best friend.
And remember, what does your best friend do?
No, Jess, this has been so good. Thank you so much. I feel like, I genuinely feel like I know what you do. The stress of being a general practitioner. No, you were just, I think people have an idea as to how hard it can be. Mm-hmm. I think you've just shed insight into why it is. And I think that's the purpose for the podcast. Like, that's 7 minutes and 3 minutes to write up notes before like your next patient.
Yeah.
I would never have known that.
Yeah.
So getting that insight, it really makes sense. And mm-hmm. like you said, there are going to be times where patients feel rushed, but it isn't anything that they should be taking personally. Mm-hmm. It's just because you want to do right by as many people as possible in the allocated time, right?
Yeah. I do think some GPs have a better bedside manner than others.
Yeah.
We know what some can be like, but the majority of GPs that I come across, certainly that I work with, are just working their absolute hardest all the time.
Mm.
And there's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. Well, let's get on to the quick fire round now.
We're
so
excited.
The listeners can get to know a little bit more about you.
Do I have to just say one word as an answer?
Basically, whatever comes to mind. One word, a couple of words.
Okay.
All right.
I'll try.
Work from home or work from the office?
Well, I can't work from home to the office.
Money or happiness?
I do think they're linked.
So both.
Controversial.
Okay. Favorite day of the week?
Friday.
Nice. Time in a group or time alone?
Group.
Would you rather travel to the past or future?
Oh, God, definitely the future. The past has had some dark times in it, bio.
I know it.
Yeah.
Favourite book?
Harry Potter.
Anyone particular or just the whole series?
All of them.
Wow, the Harry Potter saga.
Yeah.
You heard it here. Mm-hmm. Night out or night in?
Night in, with wine.
Of course. Who has it easier, men or women?
You know the answer to that.
I do, but just for the listener.
Obviously, men have.
Okay. You'd be surprised at some of the answers.
Anyone actually said the other way?
You have to tune in and find out.
I'd be absolutely shocked.
Name a book you think everyone should read.
Embracing Uncertainty by Susan Jeffers.
I love that.
It's a bit of a self-help book, guys, but I love it. It's all about embracing uncertainty, and I think that's really healthy. Seeing it as not as a threat and not something to be worried about when things are uncertain.
Learning to be comfortable in uncomfortable situations.
Yeah, yeah. And just seeing everything as an opportunity rather as something to freak out about.
And there I was thinking you were going to say Harry Potter.
I know. Also, if you haven't read Harry Potter, then obviously read it.
And then final one, are you listening to any good podcasts? It can be, you know, personal, maybe medical, that you want to share with a listener.
There's only just this one podcast. It's this bit of, he's a bit of a weird one, a bit of a weird guy. He's called Bio, and it's about like what his best friend does. That's it.
Okay, yeah. Okay. That's a nice plug. I don't know.
Is it nice?
I mean, a plug is a plug. We take it. We actually have a closing tradition on this podcast.
Do you give me money?
Do you give me money? I need money. No, basically, you know, based on everything we've discussed today, right? Mm-hmm. We've spoken about what you wanted to be growing up. We've spoken about what you're doing now, your journey to this point. Knowing what you know now, mm-hmm. what advice would you give to your 16-year-old self? And knowing what you know now, would you still be doing the same thing?
God, I just thinking about my 16-year-old self. I was very wild. I don't know what I'd say to myself. I think I'd just say, have faith. Life gets better. God, that sounds morbid. I struggled at that age. I really did. And yes, I would do what I'm doing now. Okay. I think before I discovered aesthetics and before I had a portfolio career where I felt like I had more freedom and flexibility in my life, mm-hmm. I would not have done medicine. But now that I have all that, I'm really happy I made that choice.
There you go. Have faith.
Yeah.
It clearly gets better. Jess, this has been an amazing conversation.
Am I your favourite guest?
Don't put me on the spot. It's what our best friends do. Before we wrap up, do you want to plug any socials so people can find you if they want to learn more?
You can come see me in my clinic in Nottingham and in London, Marylebone. So you can go on to my Instagram, it's probably easier. So it's @yourbeautydoctor with an underscore at the end. Mm-hmm. You can see lots of my work on there, before and afters, and you can use the link in my bio to book. And I also have a website, yourbeautydoctor.co.uk.
There you go.
Hope to see you there.
Guys, if you've made it to the end of the episode, you know what to do. Make sure you like, share, comment. If you haven't done so already, subscribe. Guys, this has been another episode of What My Best Friend Does. If you didn't know, now you know. Over and out.